Right, so I'd like to start just by thanking the organisers for the invitation to come and speak here and to tell you a little bit about how experimentally we're trying to determine the folding pathways of knotted proteins, but also to many of the previous speakers who've made my life much easier by introducing the concept of protein folding, the concept of knots in proteins, and indeed some of the proteins that I'm going to talk about. Okay, so I too stole the slide from Peter Vernau. So Peter, thank you very much. This is clearly an excellent kind of, so this is, I don't really know which screen to look at. So this is an excellent kind of representation of some of the structures of proteins that have topological knots in their polypeptide backbones, and also kind of simpler representations of these knots in the system, because they're certainly very difficult to see if you're just looking at the ribbon backbone. And I think that is the reason why for many, many, many years, until Willy and people came along, they went kind of rather unnoticed in the protein data bank. So we started some 4 years ago looking at the folding pathways of knotted proteins, and the first protein that we chose to study was an example of probably the largest family of knotted proteins, and that's the knotted methyl transferases. So here this just shows you, in fact, numerous structures of members of that family. I'll go into a little bit more detail into the structure in the next slide, but two of the proteins that we've been studying are this protein here, YibK, which is the protein which gives rise to the 185J, 1J85, anyway, the same protein that Marek was just talking about. And then also we've done some studies on the E. coli homolog of this protein called YBA. So just to say a little bit more about the structures before I go on and talk about the work that we've done in detail. So one thing which is important for my talk is that actually in the case of these methyl transferases, they're all dimers. So although in the previous slide I just showed the monomeric structures, these are the structures of the dimers. So one subunit is shown in red, one in blue, but they're homodimers. So each of the subunits is the same. So we, as I said, we started off some years ago looking at YibK. This is the structure of YibK in a bit more detail. And essentially, here, this just shows you how the knotting occurs. So in red is the threading loop created by the polypeptide chain, and the region that goes through the loop to form the knot is shown here in dark blue. So it's this C-terminal helix in this little loop region. So the protein's dimeric, and it happens that the knot region and this final C-terminal helix are important in creating the dimer interface. And this just shows a kind of simpler representation of the topology of these types of knotted methyl transferases. So when we started, we really knew almost nothing about how these proteins would be to study. And in particular, we didn't even know if we could unfold it and refold it in vitro and be able to study it. So although this is actually a rather basic slide, which we now take for granted, at the time it was a very important experiment, and it really signaled that we would be able to work on these systems at all. So I realise that I'm not talking to protein folding community, so just a very brief word of explanation. We use chemical denaturants like urea and guanidinium chloride to reversibly unfold our proteins, and we have different signals of whether the protein is unfolded or folded. Typically, we use either fluorescence or far UV circular dichroism. And we just titrate the protein with chemical denaturant, and we see these nice cooperative unfolding curves. Okay, and this just and the different colors here show that you can go from a native state and unfold it, or in fact you can reverse that and go from a denatured state at high concentrations of urea and get it to refold. So we could reversibly unfold and refold the proteins in vitro. And again, if it was a protein folding audience, I'd go into much more detail. But because these proteins are dimeric, it turns out that their stability as measured by chemical denaturation is protein concentration dependent. So as you increase the protein concentration, so purple, we've got a low protein concentration, you increase the stability and the midpoint of unfolding. And that's very, very typical of dimeric proteins. And if you take all that, you take all that data, you can fit it to a variety of models and show that the protein actually unfolds via a three-state model where we go from the dimeric native structure to a monomeric intermediate, and then that unfolds to a denatured state. So here, D is denatured, N is native, I is an intermediate. And this just shows you what the population does. So the population of native protein suddenly decreases here. The concentration of the denatured protein increases here as we unfold it. And you get a little blip here. So you hardly populate the intermediate state, but you can show from the fitting that it has to be there. And so we've used this to get some information about the intermediate state. So this was our first study, and we take all this for granted, as I said. So we showed that actually we can reversibly unfold it and refold it. And so we know that we don't need any kind of accessory proteins which might be there in the cell. So, for example, we don't need any molecular chaperones. We've got various probes to study the folding, and we can show that under equilibrium conditions, its folding can be described by this three-state model with the monomeric intermediate, and that monomeric intermediate has considerable stability and also structure, but it isn't quite as structured as the monomer within the dimer in the crystal structure. So it has lost a little bit of structure. And in fact, under equilibrium conditions, the unfolding of this protein is quite similar to lots of other dimeric proteins. So there's nothing unique about it. Okay, so we then went on to do kinetic studies. And it will become clearer in the next two slides. We actually ended up doing some experiments where we looked at the oligomeric state of the protein as a function of pH. And whereas at neutral pH, the protein is entirely dimer, so these just show some gel filtration results, as you lower the pH, you can begin to populate a monomer, and by pH 4.5 at low protein concentrations, we can actually get the protein in a monomeric form. And that was quite important for us to elucidate various phases in our kinetics. Okay, so this slide here is really the crux of the paper that resulted. And this shows an incredible amount of work. I can't remember how many months or years it took Anna to do this, but essentially what this is, okay, is we can measure the unfolding and the refolding of the protein as a function of chemical denaturant concentration. Okay. When we unfold the protein, so these are called chevron plots. They're very common in protein folding. And so essentially on this side of the plot, on the right-hand side of the plot, we have high concentrations of denaturant and we're unfolding the protein. And this side of the plot, we have low concentrations and we're refolding. And it's been well known since the 1960s that the observed rate constants for unfolding and refolding have, the logarithm has a linear relationship with the chemical denaturant concentration. Okay. So I'm going to spend a minute or two going through this slide. So when we unfold the protein, we actually just see a single unfolding phase, which is this phase down here, which is actually quite slow. When we refold the protein, we see four refolding phases, okay, which correspond to these shown here in red, green, light blue, and dark blue. if we do some more complicated experiments, which are called interrupted refolding experiments, then we can begin to get the phases over here that correspond to these refolding arms here. So essentially what you do is you take the denatured protein, you don't allow it to refold all the way to the native state, you stop it at some point along the way, and then you unfold from that state. And so you can get these phases here. And we did this at three different pHs. Okay, so just to kind of provide some context, if you've got a small protein, say 100 amino acids in length, you typically just see one of these, a single kind of phase for both unfolding and refolding. So you'd have a kind of single chevron, not this quadruple chevron that we have here. Okay, and so what that means is the folding pathway is quite complex. There were two, so I've already said it's the protein's a dimer. There were two experiments we did which basically established that these slow phases, which are actually rate limiting, are due to the dimerization. So one of which was we looked at a protein concentration dependence of the refolding rate, and we saw observed a change down here. And also we did the experiment at pH 4.5, where we know it's primarily monomeric, and we lose our dark blue refolding phase down here. Okay, so I talked about the complex, the interrupted refolding experiments that we did. And what those allow us to do is they allow us to look at how the species corresponding to each of the phases develops with time. So for example, so this is the data shown here. So it's a little easier to see on the inset, which just shows fast times. But the refolding phase corresponding to our green phase, we can show that, in fact, it starts slow, it then increases rapidly, and then decays. And this is true of other phases as well. And then there's a kind of lag phase, which you can hardly observe here, which then goes into the formation of the native state, which is that slow blue phase. So to cut a long story very short, we fitted the data to all kinds of different models. We knew that there had to be several intermediate states. We fitted the model to off-pathway intermediates, parallel pathways. So some of the data showed that we had species which were evolving in parallel. And essentially, what we came up with is the simplest pathway that fitted all the data, which is the pathway that I've shown here. Okay, so this is a bit more complicated than the majority of mechanisms you see for at least small proteins. So we had evidence that we had two parallel pathways and that we had some form of heterogeneity in the unfolded state. Okay. The denatured state. So here we have two alternative denatured states, and we refold in parallel to both states to different intermediate structures. These intermediate structures then fold again to a third intermediate structure, which is common between the two, and then the rate limiting step is the folding and dimerization of this intermediate species here to the native structure. And we can get rate constants for all these different phases. Okay, so we established it folds with complex multiphasic kinetics, that dissociation and association of the dimer are rate limiting both for folding and unfolding, and that we get this model with parallel pathways, intermediate states, and final intermediate state, which falls to the native state. And our simulation suggested that the intermediate states are on pathway. So we got a lot of information about the kinetics by which this knotted protein folds, but didn't get any information directly about where the knotting may occur. So as I said, this is quite a large family of knotted proteins. So we decided we would also look at one of the other members of the family to see if we could see kind of common features that we could attribute to the knot formation. So this is actually YBK down here. We also studied YBEA, which is shown up here. So again, a very similar structure and very similar kind of threading loop and knotted region. In fact, in this case, the dimer, it's also a dimer, but interestingly, the dimer interface is slightly different from YBK. And we also undertook a kinetic analysis of this protein. So before we do any kinetics, we also just do thermodynamic experiments. So we showed that just like YBK, under equilibrium conditions, it populates the monomeric intermediate state, which is quite stable and quite structured. Okay, so it turned out that YBA actually has considerably fewer unfolding and refolding phases than YBK. It just has two, which is shown here. Again, we can do the same interrupted refolding experiments model the data so we can get a much simpler kinetic pathway out where we don't have to have parallel pathways. We still have to go through some intermediate state. And the rate limiting step, at least at low concentrations of denaturant, is actually the dimerization step or the dissociation step if you're going in the unfolding direction. But interestingly for YBA, we also see that there's this crossing of the phases towards higher concentrations of denaturant, and we see a change in rate determining steps. So, and this is not the only example where you see a change in rate determining step as you change the concentration of the denaturant. So, I'll go back just for a second. So, and say a little bit about the parallel pathways here. So the parallel pathways here, we attributed to proline isomerization. So for those of you who don't know, the YBK has a proline and a cis conformation in the native state. When you denature the protein, there's no particular energetic reason why it isomerizes to the transform. And so you set up this equilibrium in the denatured state between the cis and the transform so that when you refold, you often see heterogeneity. And as YBK had a cisproline, it made sense that this heterogeneity here came from this cisproline. I'll go on later to say that we actually don't believe that that's what's causing this heterogeneity any longer. So with YBA, so this just compares the two pathways of the two knotted methyl transferases. And in fact, with YBA, in fact, it doesn't have a cisproline, so we weren't all that surprised that it didn't show these parallel pathways. It also only appears to populate one intermediate state rather than two intermediate states compared to YBK. And we think that the reason for this is that it's intrinsically actually a much less stable protein. So whereas the early intermediates in YBK are stable, they're not stable and therefore not directly observable for YBA. So in many ways, there were some, despite the fact that we see fewer phases, there were some similarities between the folding pathways of YBK and YBA. So for example, some of the rate constants for the formation of the late intermediate and also the rate constant for the final rate limiting step are very similar. And I didn't have time to go into detail, but the structural properties of the late intermediate state are very similar to the intermediate state we observe with YBA. So this begins to give us some feel that perhaps these two proteins, which are structurally related and both knotted, are folding in a similar way. Okay, so I think I might miss this bit or go quickly through. Working, I'll go very quickly through this. Working with a dimer is really annoying. Okay, everything is protein concentration dependent. You have to use lots more protein. It'd just be much simpler if these things were monomers. So we did go to efforts to make a monomer. And again, to cut a long story short, we took a lot of mutations in the dimer interface and disrupted them. We showed that we'd made a monomer. We showed that there were slight changes in the structure of the protein when we made the monomer, and we've certainly lost a little bit of secondary structure, but the protein is still overall very compact and very stable. And we looked at the kinetics, and very rewardingly, if we just compare this with this, we just lose this dark blue phase, which corresponded to dimerization or dissociation of the dimer. Probably the most interesting thing that came out of this particular study was, and we went through all the kinetics again and essentially just come up with a kinetic scheme which is the same as the wild type, but we don't have this last step here. But probably the most interesting thing about the monomer was that it wasn't active. Okay. So these are methyl transferases. It's not known exactly what the substrate is, but one of the clear indicators which would be necessary for function would be binding of the cofactor. And so we've looked, so there's a cofactor, adohomocysteine, which binds to the wild type quite tightly and is absolutely required for the function of the protein. And so this just shows an isothermal calorimetry experiment measuring the binding. So this just shows binding to wild type. And I think even the computation people, I don't need to convince them that there's absolutely no binding going on in the monomer. So certainly the dimeric structure is absolutely essential for the function. And I think it's interesting that part of the knotted region and the region that comes through the threading loop is part of that dimer interface. Okay, so that didn't tell us much about knotting either. And this is one of the things which I think experimentally is actually a very, very, very difficult thing to be able to detect. So we then did some experiments where we actually perturbed the system quite a bit. So what we did is we made some fusion proteins. So this is UK here. And we took a protein domain. It's a domain from a protein called phi S. It doesn't matter what the function is or what the fold is. You just have to know that the phi S is a very stable folded protein of about 80 amino acids in length. Okay. So we made fusions of this stable protein to both the C terminus and the N terminus of both YIPK and YBA. And what we knew was, because we knew the stability of YIPK, and we knew that this was very, very stable, we knew we could be able to unfold the YIPK whilst retaining the stable folded phi S domains, and then refold it to see what effect these domains had. And our arguments were that putting such a large kind of what my student called a molecular plug on the ends of the domains, the ends of the knotted domain, should affect any rate of threading or knotting. So this might be a way of actually being able to detect threading and knotting in our kinetic experiments. So she made multiple constructs, which are all shown here. So she put the domains on the N-terminal end, on the C-terminal end, on both ends. So we didn't do high-resolution structural studies, but we did do some small-angle X-ray scattering experiments on these to show that, on the whole, they adopted structures which were consistent with a folded dimeric YIPK domain and a stable folded phi S domain. Okay. So we've got a reasonable handle on structure. We also used our ligand binding, because again, we'd shown that the ligand didn't bound to a monomeric form. that I think most disruptions in structure in the knotted region would result in a disruption of ligand binding. And again, this is just to show you that all of these fusion proteins actually do bind ligand. So again, this was a good control that suggested that the protein was knotting and forming its kind of regular structure and therefore could function. So again, this just shows you equilibrium measurements, and all you need to get from this is the fact that we can specifically either unfold the YIBK domain, which is shown by this transition here, or the thiS domains. So we then went on and measured the folding kinetics of all of these different fusion mutants, and the results are shown here both for YIBK and also for YBA. And if you compare the folding kinetics to the wild type unfolding kinetics, they're remarkably similar. Okay, surprisingly so. And so what this has led us is to a model. So in fact, first of all, you can make these fusion proteins, which again, I wasn't convinced that we would be able to do. The fusions at the C terminus are some of the deepest knots known, because they're threading some 100 amino acid residues now through that threading loop. The structure and activity appear to be retained, but there's very little effect on the folding kinetics. And to us, what that suggests is that actually that the knotting and threading event is occurring very early on in the folding pathway in a very denatured-like state, or a state which hasn't got very much structure yet. So it will allow this large folded domain through the threading loop. Okay, how long have I got? Okay, this is 15. Oh, I'll go slowly on this next bit. Or we can all go early for tea. So this is the last bit that we've been doing, where again we've been trying to explore in more detail the exact mechanisms by which these proteins fold and thread. And that's by doing some kind of protein engineering studies. Okay. So again, we're still using YIBK, and in fact still using the dimer. And what we've done is we've targeted by protein engineering some of the residues that are really integral to the knot. Okay, so these are residues so this is the kind of topology diagram now, helpfully drawn the other way around by my postdoc. But this is a kind of knotting region here, and you can see that there are these three beta strands which form a little mini sheet which kind of lie at the heart of the knot. So in our protein engineering studies, we've targeted a number of residues, a number of hydrophobic residues which are in that region. And so we've chosen four residues, so leucine 57, which is this side chain here, phenyl 76, which is shown in dark blue, leucine 78 in light blue, and tyrosine 96 in purple. So we've mutated each of those residues to alanine and then looked at the effect of those mutations on the stability and the folding kinetics. So in addition, one of the things we just wanted to double check was that the parallel pathways that we'd assigned to the isomerization of this proline residue were really due to proline isomerization. So the cisproline that I've mentioned before is this proline 34 down here, which you can barely see, but which is in orange. It's also up here in the other monomer. So we've also mutated that to alanine, so we've removed, hopefully, the cis-peptide bond. Okay, so the first thing we do is always determine what effect the mutations have on stability. As expected, because these are all buried hydrophobic residues, they all destabilize the protein by different amounts, Phenylalanine 76 is the most destabilizing. This is just shown here in blue. So these are all color-coded, so the same residue, the same colors are used throughout in the thermodynamics and the kinetic experiments. But all of these mutants actually also bind the cofactor. So again, there's lots of evidence that they're dimeric and that they form the wild-type native structure. So we have perturbed the system, but we try not to be too perturbing. Okay, so again, this shows an awful lot of work. So this is the unfolding and the refolding kinetics now of all the mutants. And on each of the plots, I've shown the wild type values, and there are two lines here because we just repeated, because I had an undergraduate project student, and before I wanted to be sure that they really knew what they were doing before we gave them the mutants. So they had to repeat all the wild type values. And then on these other plots, the wild type values are all shown in black, and then the colored lines show the data for the mutants. And hopefully what you can see, particularly in the case of L75A, F76A, and L78A, there's very, very little effect of the mutants on the first two phases, either on the folding phases or the unfolding phases. For Y96A, there is a little bit of effect on the unfolding arm of the first two phases, but the majority of the effects are on the two slowest phases down here. And in each case, and as expected, because we know that these destabilize the proteins, the refolding is slower. But most surprisingly of all were the results we got for the proline 34 alanine mutant. Okay, so this protein should no longer have a cis-peptide bond. There are examples where you mutate cis-proline residues to alanine and they remain as a cis-peptide bond, but things change because it's now a cis-peptide bond but not a proline bond. So even if it's remained cis, we should have been able to see changes which would be attributable to the fact that it had kept that particular conformation even with the alanine. And this just shows you the kinetics. So what we expected to see from the kinetics and what people have seen in other kind of simpler structures is you just remove one of the phases and then you can attribute that phase to a proline isomerization limited event. And hopefully what you can see here is that actually there's, particularly in the folding, there's almost no change at all. And there's a little bit of an effect on the unfolding of the two slowest phases. And again, this mutant has slightly destabilized the protein. But there's still four phases, so there's still parallel pathways. So we now have to think that we can't attribute those parallel pathways just to a proline isomerization linked event. Okay, so all that comes together in our kind of our model of how this protein might fold. So just to talk you through this, we have a kind of denatured ensemble over here where we believe that some of the population may be unknotted, some of the population may be knotted. Okay, but there's some heterogeneity in here which is not linked to proline isomerization and which gives rise to those parallel pathways. And in these structures, those residues that we've targeted in the knotting region do not form their interactions, okay? So they're not in a highly structured region, okay? We then fold to our intermediate states, our first two intermediate states, which we believe to be knotted. They're quite compact, as judged by M values and other parameters. But again, the interactions of these hydrophobic side chains within the knotted region are yet to be made. There's then another folding event where we begin to form the tight interactions in the knotted region. And then a rate limiting step where we also consolidate the structure and dimerize the protein into its native structure. So we believe from all our data that the data is consistent with a model in which the threading forms very early, but then folding and the interactions that are in the native state, which help to maintain the knot region, are not formed. Okay, and that's really just all summarized in this slide here. So again, I've just said this, we think that the polypeptide chain threads to form a very loosely knotted structure, and we think this occurs very early on, but that the interactions that help maintain the tightly knotted structure occur late in folding, and that the parallel folding pathways are not due to proline isomerization and may be due to threading or knotting events. Okay, so just in the last minute, most of the work we've done has been on knotted methyl transferases. In the last 6 months, we've started some work on UCHL3, this ubiquitin hydrolase, which has a more complex knotted structure where it's got five topological crossings of the chain. And again, thanks to Peter for providing, unbeknownst to him, this diagram for me. Again, we've been able to show that we can reversibly unfold this protein in vitro. It's monomeric, so things are a bit simpler than the methyl transferases. There's nothing special about the equilibrium behavior of this protein that suggests that it's got a knot there. And we've begun now to look at the kinetics of folding. Again, they're quite complex. They look like they're not quite as complex as UK. We certainly haven't got as far with this particular system. Again, we've got a rather slow rate-limiting unfolding step here. You can ignore this down here. This is due to proline isomerization, but we expect this. And again, we've got several refolding phases, which almost certainly correspond to the formation of intermediate states. So we've really haven't got to the point where we can put together a kinetic model of how this folds, but this is something hopefully in the next 6 months we'll be able to do. So hopefully I won't go through that because I've really just said it. So hopefully what I've done is convince you that although it's quite challenging, you can begin to look at the folding of these knotted proteins experimentally, and that you can, through clever-ish experiments, begin to get some information about the knotting and the threading events, despite the fact that these are things which you cannot see directly, and certainly can't see as easily as you can in kind of computational simulations. So I'll end by just acknowledging the people in the group who did all the work. Almost all of the work on YIBK and YBA was done by Anna Malham, who was a PhD student in my group and who is now a postdoc. The small-angle X-ray scattering work was done by Günter Grossmann, who I've called I've called Anna the Queen of Speed. Günter Grossmann, who I think is the king of SACS. Liz Morris was a project student in my group in the last year who's looked at the mutations in the core and knotted core region, and Fred Anderson, who's a Swedish postdoc in the group now, is just starting to look at the ubiquitin hydrolases. So thank you for your attention.